Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to a special edition of The Wonky Show. I'm Rachel Firth, who normally hosts three lovely guests chatting through the latest in HE policy. But don't worry, we'll be back to that next week. But this week we have a little treat for you all. Every week last season on the podcast, we delved deep into the sector's past to uncover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's academic registrar, Mike Radcliffe, please enjoy an uninterrupted, box set style binge listen of the hidden history of HE.
I think one of the things about university history is that we've always had it. We've always been interested in the previous history and what's been going on. So my favourite little bit is the fight between Oxford and Cambridge to be the oldest. So they set off, and we, the historians, know that there's learning happening all over the place, and slowly it coalesces into universities. But we know that Cambridge gets a big shot in the arm when there's a big riot in Oxford, and sufficient students and lecturers go over to Cambridge and get it going. And it's 1209 and it's fine, and off they go. But that sets up a precedence that clearly if people left Oxford to go to Cambridge, then Oxford must be older than Cambridge. But all of the kind of precedence sits on who's the oldest university. So they get to the 17th century, and this isn't enough. So you get this battle between these mad antiquarians as to who can be the oldest university. And they start producing books. So, I mean, this would be great, be referable stuff. And they start making up quotes in order to guarantee that my university is older than your university. So Oxford kind of kicks off by saying that it was founded by King Alfred. So that puts it about 400 years older than it ought to be. But King Alfred founds it, and they find a quote that a guy sticks into a translation of Asser's Life of Alfred, saying that St. Grimble came over to found the University of Oxford. And he just puts it in this edition of the book. And it's completely bogus, but he just shoves it in. So that proves that Oxford is founded around 800. So that makes it, you know, nice and old. But then, in a next edition, they decide that that's not enough. So they find an even older quote. And that says that Grimble didn't found it, he reformed it. And that it had been founded 400 years earlier than that by a bunch of Anglo-Saxon saints. And they list all those saints out, and that's all very nice. And so they got a list of these people. And so they're much older. So clearly they managed to push that back. And why is that? Well, Cambridge has meantime got to found that they've been founded by someone called Canterbury's. And he's been helped by King Arthur. So that pushes them earlier than King Alfred. So they've been founded by King Arthur. And King Arthur's gone and found Athenian philosophers to come over. And he's made his university. And they're, so they're much older than Oxford. So clearly there's then a reaction. And so Oxford seems to trump the entire thing by coming up with this ruse. And it coalesces with the idea that England must be really old and ancient. It can't just be, you know, an accident of successive waves of people invading it. So they were founded by the Trojans, who had escaped the siege of Troy, and they'd sailed around the Mediterranean, and they had arrived, and they'd set up the University of Oxford. And to deal with the fact that there's a small issue of there not being any Greek temples in Oxford to prove that it's actually, you know, founded 2,000 years before Christ, they add this extra embellishment that it was burned down by the Romans. So they're so old that they were burned down by the Romans. So this backwards and forwards in order to get precedence produces these books. So each of the universities has a published book that lists their history up to the conquest, 1066. We know that the universities could not have been in existence until at least 100 years after. But these guys have produced these fabulous books saying, we're so old that we've been going for so long. One of the interesting things, if you think about the development of the English higher education sector, is how come the Scots, by the end of the 16th century, have five universities and the English only have two. Aberdeen has as many universities as England has. So why does this? We end up in this very strange situation? Well, one of those key reasons is that Oxford and Cambridge get quite comfortable being universities, and they are very good at patronising the king and getting the king to stop other universities. So there are two key examples of where the established universities kill off the opposition that they have. So the first of these is the University of Northampton. So Northampton, which now has a perfectly nice university, doesn't have any lecture theatres, but it has a perfectly nice university. And its original university in the city was founded way back, time of Henry III, and it's another offshoot. So problems at Oxford, some of the students get up and go, they coalesce in Northampton. But the problem is that this is a time of civil war, and so the students there, although the university gets going, they pick the wrong side. So they pick Simon de Montfort's rebels. And so when the king's army comes near Northampton, they use their arrows and bows, or their bows and arrows even, to fire on the king's troops. So this doesn't endear the king to the students of Northampton, because they're clearly rebellious and they don't like him. But meanwhile, the University of Oxford has decided, well, it's not very keen on Northampton. It's a bit close in terms of its monopoly. And it petitions the king to say, can we have this place stopped? Because it will harm our city of Oxford. And he gets the bishops on his side, and therefore the king has a writ, and the University of Northampton is dissolved and got rid of. And the other attempt comes in Stamford in Lincolnshire, which sadly doesn't have a university to this day, a fine FE college, but no university. And it gets another offshoot university. A group of rebellious scholars get up and go. Migration is a technique used all over Europe to found new universities. So they migrate and off they go. But again, there's a petition from the two existing universities to have it stopped. And so they get the king to issue another writ. And what's fun in its kind of scheme of things is that Oxford inserts a clause into the oath that you swear to become a master. When you take your Master of Arts degree, you swear an oath. You uphold the statutes of the university, but you also uphold an oath never to teach at Stamford. So in the oath that they then continue to swear for the next 500 years, everyone is absolutely saying that you'll only teach at Oxford and Cambridge and never at Stamford. So they have to get rid of this clause in the beginning of the 19th century, because actually some people say, well, I can't teach at UCL. What becomes UCL? Because I swear on this oath that I can't possibly do this anymore. Oh, that's wildly out of date. So Oxford and Cambridge do their best to get rid of other universities. The first European university, the thing that we think of, now there's a debate about whether African and Middle Eastern cities had things that are effectively universities, and they seriously antedate the European university. But the thing that we think of as a university, universitas, is a guild. And it's first set up as a guild by a bunch of law students who've gathered in Bologna. And their problems are issues with the townspeople who keep trying to fleece them, but also issues with the people who are teaching them. So the university, the guild of people in that city, is formed of the students. So it's a guild of the students. Universitas means the collection of everybody in a place doing something. You can have a universitas of cobblers. In this case, it's a universitas of students. So they set up a guild, and it has a set of rules. And the rules are relatively straightforward for the students. There's a set of rules about not fighting each other, but apart from that, it's very limited in terms of the student regulations. All the regulations are all about the staff. So they're all about the staff are supposed to turn up on time. There's some very strict rules about they have to start when they have to start the lectures and when they have to finish them. And if the lecture's going on for too long, the students are obliged to get up and go to show their displeasure at the at this kind of tardiness. There's clear rules about following the curriculum, not skimping on the hard bits, making sure the students understand the curriculum properly, and not getting into any of the dubious, teaching the coasting bits. So they've got to make that clear. Their staff have to swear allegiance to the student's rector. They aren't allowed out of town without asking permission to the students. They have to get permission to do that. And obviously the way the staff get paid is through the student fee. So yeah, there's a clear economical link, but the students have all these rules. When you get to Northern European universities, they're more theological in focus, and so it's the bishop's chancellor who takes charge of organisation, and these become master's universities. So Northern European universities are master's and scholars' universities, whereas a group of the Italian and Southern European universities are student universities. So you get this dichotomy of organisational structures. In the 17th century, the big motif is religious intolerance. So the first English university founded after Oxford and Cambridge, and that really gets going, it's in Massachusetts. So a group of English people are having a terrible time with religious oppression, so they sail across the Atlantic, which is not a pleasant experience, and they set up Harvard. They attract some money from Mr. Harvard. He gives them the cash. They set up a college where they can be free. They don't want to send their sons back across the Atlantic to Oxford and Cambridge, where they will get a poor religious experience because they won't get the right kind of religious teaching. They're also a bit nervous about sending them across the Atlantic because this is a very dangerous thing to do. So they set up their own college. So you start with a sense of people having their own religious experience. The English Civil War is full of examples of what happens to English universities. Obviously, in both cases, armies camp out in those cities, so that becomes very problematic. But as you go through, fellows are excluded from each side. So the parliamentarians will come and chuck out all the high church people. Then after the Civil War, the high church people get back and the Puritans are thrown out again. And we go back through these cycles. It comes to a peak under James II because he starts including Catholics into the Protestant universities, and there's a huge run. And there's a strong case for saying that his behaviour in trying to put Catholics into Magdalen College, Oxford, is the tipping point that induces the rebellion against him and ends his reign. So student politics, or getting students into university, could be said. It's a bit tenuous, but there's a sense of, well, hang on a second, this could be a really big problem. So in terms of the religious conflict, you've got a whole setup of this is really complicated stuff. Oxford and Cambridge are the king's universities. They have become religious in flavour, and therefore getting the right people in there who are going to teach the young becomes very important. So you get various bits of what now seem to be absolutely extraordinary legislation that comes in that sets out who should be in these universities and who's allowed. So the first one is the Act of Uniformity in 1662. So for anyone who's keen on the Book of Common Prayer, this is where that comes from. But it says that any head, fellow, chaplain or tutors in any college hall or house of learning, every public professor and reader of either of the universities has got to sign the declaration and acknowledgement. So they've got to sign up to being a Church of England person. If they don't get a licence from the bishop, they could suffer the fate of 3 months imprisonment. So if you don't get the bishop's license, you can be locked up for 3 months. So this is a really harsh penalty on anyone who's in a position of saying, well, I'll want to teach, but you'll get locked up for 3 years. So after we've had the James II experience, and everyone's very keen that Catholics aren't allowed anywhere near universities, and the test acts are in place, there's a slight variation under that on William and Mary, with the Act of Toleration, which allows dissenters to worship, and they ease off on dissenters, i.e., you know, Baptists and Methodists, are being allowed to teach people at all, and they are allowed effectively to set up what become known in retrospect as dissenting academies. So these are one-man bands to start with. You get a master who will then teach the students. Slowly over time, some of them survive. So they someone else takes it over, and they get kind of corporate status. And some of them get to be really good. So some of them are probably offering a better education than you could get in Oxford or Cambridge, because they're up to date, they believe in teaching science, they're less keen on Aristotle than the Oxford curriculum. So they start to really get going. Now, there's a great project at Queen Mary College looking at dissenting academies, and they reckon there's about 220 of these colleges between the 17th and 19th century. So there's lots of them, and they educate. They've tracked something 11,000 students. So these are getting, in total, probably as big as Oxford and Cambridge are themselves. So some of them are really important. But the fact that they build this demand sets the tone for the beginning of the 19th century, and effectively the sense that why are we excluding dissenters, so good Protestants, why are we excluding these people from universities? And it sets the kind of the background for what will become the University of London and University College Cambridge and King's College. So you get a beginning point, you get a kind of sense of we're going to take these things forward. But people, you know, big name people like Joseph Priestley, they come through the dissenting academies. This is the best place in England to get a top-class education. If you want a top-class education otherwise, certainly by the 18th century, you've either got to go to Belgium or you've got to go to Scotland. Because what happens at Oxford and Cambridge is effectively you're joining a hunting club with a lot of booze attached, because there isn't much education going on. And generally, there's a sense from scholars that everything is kind of a bit fallen apart by then. But they come right in the end to become the beacons of excellence. So one of the issues du jour is the issue of a commuting university. What are we doing for commuting students? Well, one of the biggest reforms in the 19th century was to set up a commuter university. What originally was called the University of London, we know it now as University College London. And it was set up explicitly to be a commuter university because the vices of the residential university, Oxford and Cambridge, were so obvious to everyone that you wanted to avoid that at all costs. So, the pitch comes in a staged letter to the Times from Thomas Campbell to Lord Brougham, in which he sets out a kind of prospectus for a university. He goes on to embellish it some more. But the prospectus is pretty clear that there's a group of people who are not being catered for in the higher education sector, and they are the middling rich. This is the group we need to go after, he says. These are the people who have some money, can't afford the expense of sending their sons, all the stuff is about sons. We can't afford the expense of sending our sons off to university. It will cost you far too much. So we need something for them to stay at home and commute to university. Now, Campbell works this all out. He works out how many middling rich families are within a 2-hour walk of UCL. So if he puts it in Bloomsbury, he knows how many people, you know, what his catchment is. He sets out what might happen to them, so that they'll come, they'll have breakfast early at home, they'll come in for several hours, receive instruction, they can stay in the university in that time, and then they'll go home again, always in the hours of daylight, to their parents' houses, where the parents will be in charge of them. So, and he says in the letter, their parents might know how every minute of every day of their life was employed. So the idea the parents are completely in charge. In the original sense of the perspectives of the place, he imagines a weekly report going home with the students to show what they've done during that week. And the idea is to save vast amounts of money for families that might have a couple of £1,000 a year income. And this won't be ruinous. It won't be ruinous in terms of the cost, but also it won't be ruinous in terms of sending your son away where you have no idea what they're doing for 8 weeks, and all that you might get is bills sent back from their ruinous life in Oxford or Cambridge. So you've got much more control of them. It's also really important because what you do on Sunday is your decision. So it doesn't matter what church you go to, because it's not the University of London's problem which church you go to on Sunday. So it can avoid the question of religious tests because it's not in charge of your morality. So it doesn't matter to them how you pray. You can get on and do it. So as far as they're concerned, that gets them out of the problem about dissenters, gets them problem about Jews. They're in a position where that's not their problem. So if you can come and study the instruction, your parents are going to look after your morality. That's not our job. So they won't teach religion because there's no need for you to be taught religion because you'll be going to the church of your choice. You won't need to get it from us. It's full of really up-to-date ideas. So in order to get it going, they need to set up a company. So it's set up a company and it's supposed to have subscribers. And the good news about being a subscriber is that you pay your £100 and then you can send a student. So as a shareholder, you get a guaranteed place at university for your son as a kind of recompense for that. So that's an interesting prospect. It would be good for the new College of the Humanities if they'd gone for that route. So you can set it up. The professoriate aren't going to be funded out of endowments. They're just going to collect the student fees. So they're going to be paid out of the student fees. So that's how they're going to get funded. They're going to get spread across lots more disciplines. And to mark the whole thing off, It emerges very quickly that what they want to do is have much more open study. Campbell goes on a trip to Berlin to look at the new university there. He receives correspondence for how the University of Virginia is set up. So he wants to have a much more elective system. Students can study whatever they want. He brings in professors in all sorts of practical subjects. So it's not just learning the classics. And so he sets up a different kind of understanding of how that should be. Pretty soon, there's a reaction. Because how can this place be saying it's going to offer a degree if there's no religious instruction, if no one has a sense of the morals of the men that have passed through it? So the kind of reactionary approach is the Tories set up their own campaign to set up a college. And they get the King's support, which is why King's College gets to be set up in opposition to the University of London. And it sets up to do pretty much the same kind of thing, commuting students, a wider range of subjects, but with religious education at its heart. So they want to be a different kind of setup, but within the sphere of the Church of England, because that's important to them. So the two colleges get off issuing certificates, because they don't have degree awarding powers, because Parliament won't award degree awarding powers to UCL, as we know it now. And so eventually the compromise comes in 1836 that the University of London is set up as a kind of effectively a government department to award degrees. So if you were looking for an exciting parallel with the OFS, the OFS validation powers to set up and approve colleges that come to it and say, can we have a degree? You could say, well, there's a parallel in 1836 in terms of the original University of London. What's interesting, of course, is the University of London has to say what's in the degree. So that takes away some of the reforming zeal of what had been at UCL, because they now have to conform to this new BA degree that the University of London puts together. But from that springs, A, the ability for someone to be taught at a college that isn't part of the direct University of London. So that enables places all over the country and in turn all over the empire to teach the University of London degree. But it also means the University of London can start to think about other subjects. So it starts to think, well, what would it look like to have just a science degree? And so they can start to think about that. And so there's a petition to have the first science degree. They can start to think about what it would look like. There's a petition to set up a social science degree. So they can start to expand the range of subjects that come into the university, and specialisms can develop from there. Durham University is set up in order to extract the vast wealth of the Bishop of Durham, put it to useful purpose. And so they get off and set off in a very clear mode that they're like Oxford and Cambridge colleges, traditional curriculum, although they do branch out and do new and exciting things like an engineering course. But what happens later is there's a civic need for higher education. So Owens, John Owens, is a merchant, and he sees, well, what Manchester needs is its own college. So he founds, by giving them a sizable amount of money in his bequest, a college to be set up. And obviously they said, oh, this is great, we'll have a university. The other towns in the north say, oh, no, you can't have a university on your own. We have to have something along the same kind of lines. And so there's a sense that, well, you can't possibly set up just one college to do that. So Owens is refused, after it's been going for a few years, the right to become a university. So what it gets is a federal university, an examining university, kind of similar to the University of London. So the university will set the exams and Owens College will do the teaching. Now, the weird thing is, for the first couple of years, it's only Owens College is the only college of this, and the Victoria University only has the one college. But Liverpool and Leeds both get their act together and set up colleges and apply to join. And so over time, they get a federal university, which is a bit of an awkward compromise. The federal university is chaired in turn by the vice-chancellors of the different universities. They all teach the same curriculum. The students all take the same examination. They're all graduates of the Victoria University. And that's ticking along okay until Birmingham wants to develop its college. It's got a college, it's got a generous donor, Josiah Mason, who's given them plenty of cash. He's a businessman. And they're setting off in the same way. They're going to have a federal university too. There's going to be a university of the Midlands. There's talk in Bristol of a university of the Southwest. This is the pattern we're all going to go to. But they, instead of proceeding on their happy path, Joseph Chamberlain becomes the president of Josiah Mason College. Incidentally, he was a business competitor of Josiah Mason, but he becomes president of this college, and part of his big thing for Birmingham is to take this college forward. But he's also made rector of Glasgow University, so he spends quite a lot of time in Glasgow, and he likes two things about that. Firstly, he likes the fact that they've taken the campus out of the city centre and put it in an attractive new campus, so he likes that idea. He also likes that it's the University of Glasgow, not some kind of mixed you know, federal university somewhere else. It's a university for the city, doing things for the city, and which people are very proud of. So when he comes back to Birmingham, he says, we're not having a federal university. We're going to have a University of Birmingham. We're not, you know, otherwise I'm going to give up and we're going to, you know, stuff the lot of you. So because he happens, just so happens to be a member of the cabinet, he bends the will of Whitehall to say, we're going to have a single teaching university. University of Birmingham will not have any extra colleges. It'll just be a university on its own. And that will be, you know, that's going to be the whole of it. He gets by dint of that to erase the name of Josiah Mason from the name of the college. Obviously not part of his original plan. So the University of Birmingham goes off on its way and Mason is gently let to be forgotten. Now this excites the people in Liverpool because they've got their university college, but they're part of the Victoria University, and they say, hang on a second, if Birmingham can have its own university, we've got to have our own university. So they petition to have the Victoria University wound up and then become a university in their own right. So you'd expect the Victoria University to object to this a bit, but the University of the Yorkshire College really objects. Probably, the speculation is, because they're a bit weedy, a bit small, and unlikely to become a university in their own right. So they make a strong objection to the winding up of the Victoria University. So Liverpool's kind of trapped. Manchester Owens College is thinking, well, we could be our own university, that'd be quite good. But Leeds is vehemently against. So the Privy Council, who's the only people in charge of universities or education at that time, forms a committee, a really high-powered committee. And the kind of people who go and pitch to this committee are Haldane, who, you know, famous for all of these other exciting higher education things, Sidney Webb, all sorts of really important reformers think the idea of a teaching university is worth pressing, so they hold this great committee hearing. And the minutes are fabulous, because there's just mad arguments. The people on both sides argue with each other, these senior politicians play out all their arguments. There's some great dialogue as people say, you know, are you bringing standards down by setting up your own university? Oh, no, we're not, etc., etc. So at the end of this, the Privy Council agree that Liverpool can be its own university, Manchester can keep the Victoria University, which incidentally is why it was called the Victoria University of Manchester through to its merger with UMIST. But then that leaves Leeds in a slightly complicated position, because Yorkshire College has been arguing that it really believes in federal universities as a way of kind of keeping the thing going. So the Privy Council turn around and say, OK, you can be a federal university. Well done. There's a college in Sheffield that'd like to join you. Now, suddenly the people in Leeds get really cold feet, because they quite now fancy the idea of being their own university and don't really want to have the Firth College people in Sheffield join them in a new federal university. So they get cold feet about this. So they write a charter saying, hello, we'd like to be the Victoria University of Yorkshire. And they send it in. But the Privy Council think, well, hang on a second, if you don't want to play this federal game, you can't be the University of Yorkshire, because you don't want to include everybody in Yorkshire in it. So there's a wonderful copy in the records in the National Archives, where what they do is they amend the charter by crossing out every mention of Yorkshire and writing Leeds in pen in the copy of the charter and send it back to them saying, you can have this charter, but you're going to be the University of Leeds. You can't be the University of Yorkshire. So it's the beginning of the end of the federal principle. When it comes to it, the universities in the colleges that form the Southwest, they're not keen. The final attempt is to set one up in the East Midlands. And so when they lay the foundation stone at the University of Nottingham, there's still a sense in the 20s that they might found an East Midlands university. But Loughborough and Leicester aren't keen. They want to have their own universities eventually. And the federal principle in England dies off. It drags on a bit in Wales until eventually Cardiff wants to pull out, and then the other institutions want to pull out, and the survivor in the UK is the Federal University of London, and all of the excitement about can they be a university with universities in them, which we're looking to find out what happens with the exciting University of London bill making its way through Parliament at the moment. If you were to pitch up at an English university in the middle of the 19th century and asked to see the research facilities, you would be very disappointed, because there were none. Firstly, the universities were mostly concerned with non-experimental sciences, so you wouldn't be shown to any great laboratories. There were some laboratories the students allowed to do things in. But original research was not, even in the humanities, something that they thought was important. So much so that if you go to the work of Cardinal Newman, his very important lectures on the idea of the university, he's quite dismissive of the idea of generating new knowledge. If the object of a university was scientific and philosophical discovery, I do not see why a university should have students. He's very clear that it's not any of their business. And certainly there are plenty of examples, and Oxford does very well at coming up with these examples, of why universities shouldn't do research, they shouldn't do science, this isn't their business. Discovery of knowledge is nothing much to do with them. So one of the great reformers of the University of Oxford is Master of Balliol, Benjamin Jowett, and he's a great idea that he reforms all sorts of things at university. He's hated by some conservatives, but one of the things he's very clear on is that research is not the kind of thing that his university should be doing, because it threatened the whole tutorial and examination system, which was making Oxford into the highest of high school for boys. So for him, it was a really bad thing, and he came up with this idea, someone talking to him. Research, the master exclaimed. Research, he said, a mere excuse for idleness. It has never achieved and will never achieve results of the slightest value. So this is the head of Balliol, very clear that this is not something that should happen. Clearly, there's an ongoing movement. There's what you get is this interaction between the new universities, places like Manchester, who start to borrow the apparatus of the research university, which is developed in the US and developed from Germany, and they work out that actually useful knowledge is A, useful to the locale, but actually is generating new things. So they both do what we might think of as applied, but also basic research. So you start to get a development. Cambridge sets up the Cavendish Laboratory in 1874 and gets an extraordinary range of people who come. Nobel Prizes developed very quickly. The fundamentals of the universe are understood by people at Cambridge. This idea that we should advance knowledge is now seen as something that we should get on to do. There is an association with Lord Kelvin, who's at Glasgow University for an extraordinary amount of time. But this is a man who perfects underwater cables, who does temperature, who does all sorts of things, polyglot of thinking about what a university should be doing, discovering things. But in other places, this is still seen as definitely a bad idea. And it only really finally gets cemented after the First World War, when the useful knowledge that universities have contributed towards the war is actually seen by both government and by society as something that is worth reflecting. And it certainly wins the argument finally in Oxford that university research is the kind of thing that they should be doing, and they start to set up the major facilities that they have, and it really kicks on from there.
Next up, more stories to be used at dinner parties and upcoming family gatherings. But before we listen to more of Mike's wonderful tales, I want to tell you about our new Wonky Plus subscription, giving you even more essential HE policy insight and access to extra wonky benefits. Along with the Wonky Daily, delivered to your inbox at 8 a.m. every day, you'll get access to the Termly Briefing, an Horizon scan and sense check about everything happening in HE policy, ideal for those who can't follow every twist and daily turn. And as a Plus subscriber, you get exclusive free access to our monthly event, Wonky Live, so you can keep up to date on all the moving and shaking in HE policy in person with Team Wonky and experts from across the sector. You get free use of the Wonky Jobs Board, plus everyone from your organisation gets discounted rates on Wonky events and early access to tickets, including Wonkfest, which always sells out quickly. For more information, contact us on briefing@wonky.com, or you can visit the website wonky.com/plus.
So how do women get their way into universities? Clear way that it starts to develop is that universities are now working as examining bodies. So the university sets the exams, and students in the colleges come and take the exams. So there's an exam to get in, and then there's an exam as you go through the university, because the matriculation exam, the exam to show that you've got the knowledge to get into university, becomes in effect a qualification in its own right. So Emily Davis, who writes a book, a whole series of things on why women should be allowed into higher education. Good to actually get a reference to that rather than me rambling like that. Emily Davis sets out the argument quite clearly that what she wants when she's educating a small group of women in a small domestic setting is a searching examination indispensable as a guarantee for the qualifications of teachers. She wants the women to have the test of sitting the examination. So what she wants is effectively a copy of the exam paper that the men are taking, and she wants to be able to set that as an exam for her female students to take. So that's all she wants. She doesn't want degrees. She doesn't want them to be taught alongside them. She just wants them to be able to take the same exam as the same kind of spur to their learning that the men are having to do. So she sets off in that kind of way. And we get small domestic scale colleges set up on that way. In London, you get Bedford College. Girton College is set up near Cambridge. The idea being that the men from the universities, the professors, could come and give some lessons to the women, and therefore they get the same kind of learning, but obviously they're not part of the university, not engaged in the overall work. So that lasts for about 20, 30 years. That kind of system is okay. But that starts to come really tested when the civic universities have to think, are they going to let women in at the same point as men? And there's quite an opening up that comes, but it has to be worked its way through. So as an example, Owens College comes under pressure in the 1870s to admit women to its lectures. And so it says, well, yes, we agree that we should have an experiment, but they can't join our college. We'll set up a separate college. So they set up the Manchester and Salford Women's College to run alongside Owens College. And that lasts 3 years until the committee says, well, can you not just take charge of it? And then they say, well, after a couple more years, they go, well, yeah, actually, that's not really working out. We'll set up a women's department. So slowly, the women gain entry to the university. At UCL, which decides it also wants to teach women, it also has this worry about co-education. It's not clear that this is a good thing for either of the two sexes. So it has a go at segregating the men from the women. So it has to think, it's going to use the same premises, so it has to think how it's going to do that. It doesn't want them mixing, they have to have separate lectures, they have to use separate laboratories. So it has this brainwave that it doesn't want them mingling in between lectures even, of putting the women's lectures on the half hour, so that they can't possibly mingle with the men because they won't even be in the corridors at the same time because their lectures are staggered. And they adapt the laboratories to put in different entrances so that women can come in from a different entrance to the men so that there's a clear segregation. Now, again, that doesn't last over time and eventually, you know, quite quickly they relent and co-education comes from that. But that idea that mixing the students is going to be a major problem continues to the 19th century. So when Thomas Holloway sets out to make a major bequest, his wife has persuaded him that what he really wants to do is set up the best education suitable for women of the middle and upper classes. Another great access statement quote. He sets up sufficient money to found a women's college. He puts it nicely out of the way, and obviously in the most splendid building you can possibly imagine, but it's an idea that it's going to be a women's college, and it will set off. There's a big discussion in the late 1890s as whether it should be the nucleus of a women's university, so a whole university and an examining university just for women, but eventually they decide they should join the University of London, and they go off on that basis. So Oxford and Cambridge have now got these colleges nearby which are educating people in the same curriculum, but they are not members of the university. So they've got this kind of beginning of a mingling, because Oxford and Cambridge is full of independent colleges, so you could put a women's college in either of those two cities, and it can educate people to the same thing. They can go, eventually they're allowed access to the same lectures, but they have to work out what to do. So the Cambridge solution, which comes after a lot of agitation from progressive academic staff to say, well, we should have women as members of the university, but a lot of reaction from what you have to call the reactionary clergy, who are all members of the university and have the right to vote on any university statute, who can come back by train to vote down any clauses that might look like that women might be allowed in. And there's a big celebration when they vote down the clause that women should be admitted to the university. They have there's a great picture of it, of a huge throng outside King's College, and men celebrating the fact that they've kept women out of the university. They have an effigy of a woman on a bike. She's wearing bloomers because they're worried that women are going to be riding around Cambridge in their bloomers. The whole place is going to change. And they get so excitable that they go out to one of the women's colleges and rattle the gates so violently that women are scared inside that the violence is going to be done to them. So they get very overexcited. So what they end up with is this wonderful, if you're part of this internal thing, compromise, whereby the women can take the exams, continue to take the exams, and they can be admitted as students, but they can't become members of the university by getting the degree. So they get to know how well they did in the exam, but they don't get the BA or MA degree, and they're not allowed to do that. Now, unfortunately, because Cambridge has this big reaction against it, they don't try during the interwar years to overturn it, or that it gets put back. So it's only in 1948 that the University of Cambridge admits its first woman graduate, who is an honorary graduate. Queen Elizabeth is admitted as the first woman graduate of the University of Cambridge. So huge amount of tussle about this. So Cambridge has a very strict list system in terms of its thing. So women knew that they were best in their year at the subject, but didn't get the degree. So obviously, things are much, much better now. Everything is solved. There's no problems at all. And that's all fine. There's obviously a series of gradations about Oxford colleges becoming mixed, about the ability of women to become academic staff. So we're better and better and better. But if you think how many, we're dealing with a generation that was alive in 1948. This is a generation that women could not graduate at one of our universities until after that point. So one of the questions that arises from educating women is, should they have a special curriculum for women? Should they be doing the same as men? What's going to be happening? Though you have to put this in context. It's very important not to take historical things out of context and laugh at people in the past. Never want to do that. But if in the context of what women's careers were like, well, what would a useful degree for women look like? So the King's College Department of Women has decided that it's going to explore what that might look like. And it gets some benefactions from outside to set up a course to think about a useful course for women to do. And they settled on household and social science as the model that they should take forward. So they start to develop a course in this. Now, this quite quickly becomes quite an important part of the college, and they transfer back to King's the English and history and other kinds of subjects, and leaving the college to really concentrate on household and social science. Now, in its heyday, you can get a proper BSc degree from the University of London in household and social science, in which you learn organic and physical chemistry, general biology, applied chemistry, bacteriology, household work, special household work, institutional management. And the tests that come with this are just wonderful. So what you get is you get these lovely publication of exam papers. So you get a sense of what people should be doing. So the exam paper from 1921 talks about what should you do for economic biology. And the question is, give an account of the habits and life history of the itch mite. Write an essay on insects and disease. So you get this kind of breadth of thing. But what makes it clear what's going on here is the practical exam that you get to sit. So one of the things you get to do is you have a day exam. You get to take the exam from in the morning. You get 10 to 1 for part one. Plan meals for a day in a middle-class family for each of the seasons. Give the quantities required and compare the energy values. What principles would guide you in the choice of food? And there's a practical exam, so that's just theoretical still, so the practical exam, 10 till 4. Prepare a day's meal for a family consisting of father, mother and two children, using as little fuel as possible. Hand in the list of fresh ingredients required by 11 a.m. and calculate the price of each meal. Second part, all utensils used are to be cleaned and left for inspection. It includes the washing up. It's a wonderful idea. Now, obviously, as this is, this is not without opposition. Some years before, there's this wonderful suffragette publication called The Free Woman, run by a woman called Dora Marsden. And she's got a friend who's at this college teaching on this thing. And she's quite forthright about this course. As you might imagine, she says, the aims of those who frame such a retrograde scheme are in radical opposition to those of women who are deserving the freedom and development of women. They aim at perpetuating women's inferiority by perfecting her in the role which puts her in the greatest difficulties of her development. I protest that a more impudent piece of charlatanry has never been perpetuated before in the history of education. Dora Marsden goes at her. Now, eventually, obviously, it wanes and it moves off. And what comes Queen Elizabeth College goes into more normal branches of science. But for a moment, there is this wonderful BSc degree in household and social science. One of the things I think makes history of higher education interesting is the amount of continuity and the amount of change that we see. So one of the things I really enjoy is looking at old regulations of how we looked after students. Sometimes that's quite useful because you get really good ideas of how you regulate students now in the present. But I think sometimes it just shows us that we're still dealing with some of the same challenges. So my favourite set of these regulations is the statutes of the Collegium Sapientiae at Freiburg University, which were written in 1497. And they are beautiful. They are illustrated, which I think is a great idea. We should run that out across universities anyway. But they cover the whole of student life. They were written by a bishop who'd been working with the university for a long time. He understood what students got up to, and he set out a complete set of rules. So it has everything you could possibly want to run a proper university. So it's got rules about how you welcome a student to the university, how you make a list of the furnishings in their room, so it gets an inventory, and so that they're clear that they've got to account for everything that's in the rooms. There's a system for allocating the rooms. It's done by lottery, so no one can have the good rooms on favouritism. And there are quite clear rules about what time you have to go to bed, and that there's study time, everyone should be quiet. You have to clean your room once a week. There's a great set of rules for how you have to make your bed immediately after you've risen in the morning, and then you get into the excitement, which is the penalty system. So the regulation says failure to comply as a result of laziness when noticed during the weekly inspection and reported to the president shall be punished by the removal of wine. If this should happen frequently, the scholar in question shall be deprived of his bed. Now, the great thing about all of these regulations is basically the tariff system is how much wine you have removed for the different infringements you go through. Now, we have to remember that obviously wine was a different kind of commodity. It was, you know, a drinkable drink. It wasn't quite the same as having your vodka-based confection taken away from you by the university, but that's how it works. You go through and you get all these punishments. So there's a whole bunch of things that these people are not allowed to do. They're kind of clerks in lay orders, so they're kind of semi-religious, but it's very clear there's lots of things they shouldn't be getting onto. So there's to be no loose frivolous or obscene song, no blasphemy and no kinds of boasting. Dice, cards and sticks for casting lots on all games of chance are forbidden. Disregard of this rule should be punished with the loss of wine for a week. Chess, however, is allowed. And it goes on. So there are these lovely things. So again, one of the things we do is we often contrast ourselves with people in the US. So there's a lot of very clear rules about no arms allowed. So you have to hand your sword into the president when you arrive at the college. If you need it back, you can go and get it when if you're going outside town, but you're not allowed to keep it in the hall. And a very clear rules about no fighting in the college and what you do with it. And as you go through the sets of regulations, each has this wonderful little illustration showing you exactly what's going on. So there's everything is beautifully set out and laid out, but it's a pocket set of rules, and most of it, probably apart from the swords, is entirely applicable to the modern university. Strange rules for regulating the lives of students probably reached their peak as the university started to modernise. And one of the things that brings that into sharp relief is when different kinds of people come to university. So there's a major phase after Oxford has admitted women and students have returned from after the First World War who are more mature, more engaged with the world, about how the university can control their lives. So there's a great moment where the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Oxford from 1920 to 1923 decides that he's going to ban elevenses, because he's decided that this is a frivolous thing for students to do. They shouldn't be doing this. He's going to ban them. And so he starts working out how to do that. And he gets this petition in from the women's colleges complaining that students couldn't stand the strain of going from 9 to 1 without sustenance. And he goes on to say, well, he thinks that it would probably be a good idea if they practice such austerity. But if you look at the rules that students are having to deal with in the 30s, they're just wonderful in terms of the depth. And students get this kind of panoply of bits of information telling what they can or cannot do, where they can stay, what they can bring with them, what they can do. So they're not allowed to bring a car. Now, current residents of Oxford would be delighted by the notion that it was very clear that you get a small slip of paper saying, don't bring a car to Oxford, you're not allowed. But the rules go on to set out all sorts of other things you can't do. Undergraduates will not loiter in the streets, at coffee stalls, or at the stage door of a theatre. They will not take the chair at any public meetings. They're not allowed to set up magazines without permission. There's a whole set of rules about not being allowed to take part in acting unless you've got permission. No one is allowed to visit any bars, strictly forbidden from going to any of the bars in the city. And there's a set of rules for how you have to organise dinner parties. Flying is not allowed without proctorial permission. You have to go and get leave before you do that. What, of course, is scary are the rules they've come up with for how to handle men and women being together. So there's a whole set of rules about the amount of chaperoning that the women members of the university, the women who've just become undergraduates for the first time are allowed. They have to have a companion approved in advance if they are to meet with a man student. And they're certainly not allowed to take them to their room. And there's a whole set of these kind of rules that work their way through. Parties of men and women undergraduates may not be held unless each woman undergraduate has previously forwarded to the proctors the written leave from the principal of her college. It is most important that academic dress should be worn. So the prospect of organising all of these things is great. Now, I thoroughly recommend Jane Robinson's Blue Stockings books, because it charts out how people actually were quietly breaking all these rules and living with them, and that not all of them were actually enforced. But there's a real tension here about how the university has decided that it is looking after people. Now, we've seen off a minister who was excited about the notion of in loco parentis. And for those of us who've looked at this kind of rule, this is what in loco parentis meant, this kind of controlling your students' lives. And I think we should be very glad that we're not trying to do that now. The English didn't use state power to set up universities. It's one of the curious things that very few occasions have the English actually used state power to set up a university. They've always bubbled up through local endeavour or through benevolence. But there is an occasion, or two key occasions, when the English have used state authority to set up universities. But they're both in Ireland. So, although there was an abortive attempt to set up a university in Dublin in the Middle Ages, the key occasion comes when Elizabeth accedes to a set of rules that you know, it would be a good idea to have a Protestant university in Dublin. And the reason for that is set out in her charter to that. The idea is that knowledge and civility might be increased by the instruction of our people there, whereof many have usually heretofore used to travel into France, Italy and Spain to get learning in such foreign universities. And this is the reason why they want to have their own university, because they have been infected with popery and other ill qualities and so become evil subjects. So Trinity College Dublin is set up with the idea of stopping the Irish becoming evil subjects. Now, I'm not sure how that goes necessarily, but it becomes a Protestant bastion, and therefore they continue on their way, shunned by the Catholics. The Irish bishops refuse to let their students go there, and so there's a gap in terms of education available to people in Ireland. And this all comes to a head in 1845, where two different but very contentious government acts take place. The first is that Robert Peel decides to extend the amount of money he's going to award to Maynooth College. So Maynooth College is a Catholic seminary. It's now developed into a multifunctional university. But the notion of giving state money to train Catholic priests is an anathema. Seriously splits the government, causes huge rows, the pamphleteers go crazy, there are long debates in Parliament about it, but it really comes to the heart of should the government be supporting Catholics, and there's a lot of rather nasty business. And Peel describes the clamour against the Maynooth Bill as the most senseless and atrocious display of calumny, hatred, bigotry and bad feeling which ever disgraced any country. Obviously he didn't have to deal with Brexit, but there we go. So there's a sense of the disgrace, you know, the real problem about setting up money to educate Catholics. The other thing he tries in 1845 is to set up a range of government-run colleges. So these, which he has the idea that they'll be set up around the country, there's a bit of a clamour as to which towns get them on, but eventually they're set up in Cork, Galway and Belfast. These are godless colleges in the model of University College London. There's no religious instruction allowed in them. They're very clear that they've got to be done. There's a weird moment that all of the architects chosen all copy Oxford buildings in order to build them. Queen's in particular gets a copy of Magdalen College Tower, so they build them in a very Oxford kind of a way. But there's still a problem that because they're now godless colleges, they're not teaching religion, the Irish Catholics still refuse to send their students to these institutions. So you end up with this problem that there's now a disagreement as to whether or not an Irish Catholic student could go to a university and be taught by a Protestant, and vice versa. So there's this, you know, you couldn't possibly talk by. Peel again comes to this point that, you know, how can this be sensible? How can we say that, you know, it would be sensible for us to object to an anatomy being taught by Roman Catholics to Protestants or vice versa? What a strange situation that is. The Irish bishops are sufficiently concerned by this that they decide to set up their own university. So what they do is sensibly invite John Henry Newman to come across. He comes across to start the Catholic University in Ireland as a small outfit to do that. And the key reason this is important is he gives some lectures to explain why it would be a good idea to have a classical education, and they form the basis of the idea of the university, which is still one of the classic foundations. So this system continues. There's a federal university that looks after the three colleges. It mutates into a royal university, which allows religious heritage institutions in 1880 to join it. So that allows the Catholic University in Maynooth and McGee College in Derry to join, and it moves on that way. And interestingly, the Irish still have that system. The National University of Ireland is the inheritor of that Colonial Act in 1845 to try and bring higher education across Ireland. Queen's obviously separates out at the beginning of the 20th century, but it's a foundation that they still have that federal system because of Robert Peel.